Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. Well, I can't say this every week, but we have got a great one today. You know, for a change, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner in economics. You heard me, winner of the Nobel Prize in economics. How many of you can say that, huh? Not many, that's for sure. Let that sink in, huh? I like to spend the first little part of the show wasting your time. You don't hear Ezra Klein do that, do you? No. Well, Paul and I cover a lot of topics today, but mainly the economy. But as it turns out, when you talk about the economy, you got to discuss other stuff as well, like the war in Ukraine. You'd never guess how that affects inflation. I'll tell you how. Fuel prices, especially in Europe. See? But it's crazy. Practically everything affects the economy. You wouldn't believe this. Immigration has an effect on the economy. Supply chain, economy. Early childhood education. Turns out that early childhood education has been shown to have a tremendous return on investment. Now, who would have thought that? You're going to learn a lot of stuff today. Very unusual for this podcast. But if that's the kind of thing you like, then stay tuned. Other stuff in the news, I mentioned the war in Ukraine. No can of horrors. That's Yiddish for don't jinx it. But Ukraine is kicking ass. They've recaptured thousands of square miles of territory during their new offensive in the east and finding unfinished letters written by Russian soldiers who are deserting, saying they can't take it anymore, they're exhausted, their equipment is horrible, they're getting wounded and killed, they haven't had any breaks. Putin is so desperate that he's recruiting soldiers from prison in Russia, releasing them from prison to fight in Ukraine. That sounds like a good deal all around. That should really help. The Junkie Patrol. That would be a good movie, I think. The Junkie Patrol. You know, they go in like a World War II movie, but just for updated. The January 6th committee is going to resume hearings. It sounds like the end of this month. Those are fun, aren't they? The Fulton County DA, Fannie Wills, is saying her Georgia 2020 election inquiry may lead to prosecution. All I need is 11,780 votes. And you'd be in trouble if you don't do that. My advice to my listeners, don't commit crimes on audio tape. Trump's definitely going down. And this time, we're really going to see the end of this guy. It's in the bag. Between Georgia, January 6th, what's going on in New York, Weisselberg has pled and has to tell the truth, or he'll go away for a long, long time. Rocket Man, long, long time. So that may mean Trump will be back in the Manhattan DA's sights. And then, of course, there is a little matter of these national security documents that he was keeping at his resort and lying about, which even sleazebags like Bill Barr are saying is a slam dunk. But we got this district court, Judge Aileen Cannon. She has appointed now a special master to sort through the 11,000 or so documents, including highly classified materials. The guy she picked is former U.S. District Court Judge Raymond Deary, a Reagan appointee whom everyone respects. Deary has been a FISA judge, ruling on a lot of national security cases during his career. But Judge Cannon won't let the DOJ have access to classified documents during Judge Deary's review period, which DOJ says presents a national security risk because we know this stuff includes top secret classified intelligence about a foreign country's nuclear weapons programs and who the hell knows what else, including sources and methods, which means we might have human sources that are now in danger and more in danger every second DOJ can't look at this stuff. So there we are. And Judge Cannon says she doesn't trust DOJ's characterization of this, which is insane. And she says the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, can look at the stuff in the meantime. But DOJ and my sources say that ODNI can't get access to this, can only get it through DOJ, which I believe over her. So DOJ is saying that they will appeal to the 11th Circuit, and first that would be heard by a three-judge panel, and however that panel decides, the loser could insist it goes to the whole 11th Circuit en banc, which means all the judges in that circuit hear the case. It's the majority of them are Trump or Republicans, but there have been Republican judge and Trump judges that have done the right things. Anyway, the loser then can go to the Supreme Court, which can or cannot take it. What I'm hoping is that Judge Deary, who knows classified material, will just turn this stuff over to DOJ as he goes through it. Now, Biden's poll numbers have gone up considerably, so nothing can go wrong. That said, in all seriousness, I want you all to get out and door knock, make phone calls. Our democracy is at stake. But first, it's time to listen to Paul Krugman. It's a great one. You know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
You're an economist, right?
Yeah. That's
a Nobel Prize winning economist. Now, what was the prize for? What was the thing you did?
Mostly work on international trade. and economic geography, which is sort of where things are located within countries as well as trade between countries.
And is that important?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's actually hugely okay. important. The geography bit has turned out to be extremely relevant now because we've had this divergence with large parts of the country, places like Jackson, Mississippi, left behind as the industries of the future go to places that have highly educated workforces and reasonably sane governments. And a lot of it was focused on unequalizing tendencies that are out there in the world economy. And it's turned out to be more relevant now than it at the time that I did the work, which is, you know, decades ago.
Yeah, well, and that's partly in large part responsible for how divided we are in our politics, where we have blue urban areas and red areas that aren't doing as well, and a lot of resentment.
Yeah, there's a whole belt of the Eastern Heartland, as some people call it, although I'm not sure I call the Deep South Heartland. But anyway, there's a whole sort of belt of the U.S. from stretching from Ohio to Mississippi, which is being left behind. Low education, lots of job opportunities have been scarce. Social dysfunction is, you know, the opioid epidemic just being part of it is rampant. And that's politics in the United States to a large extent runs along that same divide.
Now, you write a column, twice a week?
Column twice a week plus two newsletters. I'm a crazy person.
Right. You work hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Everybody should work hard.
Not necessarily. There's well, not okay. For, okay. But anyway, but
you
yeah,
can work hard and also take care of yourself. And of course, you and I exercise constantly. We eat right. Okay. So, you know, there's so much to talk about. Obviously, inflation. We can talk about the loan forgiveness. We can talk about that stuff. The last time we talked was arguing with zombies. Yeah. And arguing with zombies was basically about arguing with these conservative Republicans that they've been lying all along. And Stuart Stevens, who a Republican ad maker and was head, I think, head of Bush's campaign and top on Romney's campaign as well, wrote a book called It Was All a Lie, which pretty much echoed what you said in Zombies, I think, which is, can you sum up zombies in however long you want to sum it up?
The zombies are ideas that should be dead because they've been proved wrong by experience. Things like cutting taxes on rich people produces miraculous gains for workers. National debt is the most important issue facing the nation, that sort of thing. That although they should be dead, they just keep on shambling along, eating people's brains. And most of the zombies that matter in U.S. politics anyway are on the right. There's no principle that says you can't have left-wing zombies. I think there are a few, but it's basically on the right in the United States. So that was the book was mostly about these ideas, why they're wrong and why people cling to them. I think it was all a lie is that what really happened politically is that the U.S. right-wing movement started out by using racism, social issues, culture war stuff to get working class voters to support them. And then the policies, you know, they basically vote for me because I'll keep those people down. And then use the election wins to implement these zombie policies that basically tend to benefit the rich. I think there's been some change right now. It seems that in some ways that the right-wing ideologues who thought they were using the racists have discovered that the racists were using them. The question of who's actually in the driver's seat has kind of reversed in the last few years. It's not that they've stuck giving up on the ideas. I mean, I can't help noticing. I mean, I've been obsessing a bit about, you know, Jackson, Mississippi, the capital of a U.S. state, has no running water. it's not irrelevant that it's a mostly black city. But it's also not irrelevant that just a few months ago, the governor of Mississippi's idea for how to bring prosperity to Mississippi, which is, you know, left behind as the poorest state in America, was let's cut taxes on rich people.
We started this discussion by your saying there are kind of two Americas, or there's this red areas that have been hollowed out a lot that are poor, including Jackson, including Mississippi. And yet, part of the zombie idea was that tax cuts to the rich trickle down, and they don't. And Republicans get in, and they cut taxes to benefit the rich. And, of course, when Trump got in, that's what he did, cut taxes on the rich. It created $2 trillion, right, in debt. And it was scored that way by the Congressional Budget Office, which was appointed by Republicans. They knew it, and suddenly they didn't care about debt, right?
Yeah.
Republicans talk about, and especially these MAGA Republicans, talk about the deep state. And there seems to be a real connection to me between the deep state, and I guess what they're talking about, what is the DOJ and the State Department, stuff like that. But to me, it is the military-industrial complex. It is the Koch brothers. It seems that, I mean, obviously, Trump talked about draining the swamp. Why don't people in red states kind of put some two and two together and see that the Republican Party is screwing them?
That's the big question. And the trouble is, it's hard even to raise that question without being accused of being condescending and saying people are stupid.
Well, they get a lot of disinformation.
They get a lot of disinformation. There's really an information monoculture there. Stuff is frozen out. The world that someone who gets their news from Fox perceives, there is no resemblance to the world that, well, to the world that obviously those of us who have other information sources perceive, but I think it's also fair to say bears no resemblance to the real world. I mean, it's amazing how many people, to take an example of something that should be really obvious, a lot of people out there believe that Black Lives Matter demonstrations burned America's major cities to the ground. You just have people who think that New York City, which is where I live most of the time, that New York City was in flames during those demonstrations about George Floyd. It's not as if it's a hard thing to walk around New York City and see that it actually, you know, there isn't a whole lot of rubble there. I'm not sure that walking people around would change their mind. This is what they've been told to believe, and so they believe it.
Okay, you write columns every week, or several times a week, sorry.
Yeah.
And so lately it's been a lot on inflation in the last few months. The way they measure inflation, of course, if you hear July, you'll hear what the inflation over the last year has been, right?
Well, you get monthly data and
the monthly data was zero or less than
monthly
zero.
Monthly data,
right?
Was zero in July. It's slightly negative, probably going to be about the same in August.
And that was gas prices to a large extent, right?
Gas prices and a bunch of other stuff. And we can get into that. But it's amazing how many sort of leading indicators are suggesting that we're going to have at least a few months of very low inflation.
That's good. I mean, it's a relief for everybody. If you know, I talked to the head of Unite here, detailer, and they knock on doors. So knocking on doors is the best polling there is. And that's what people are concerned with, is their rent and their food and their gas.
And those are salient. The odd thing is they're, you know, politically, they matter enormously, even though they're the things over which presidents have almost no influence.
And you've pointed out that if you look at what the inflation rate is all over the world, we're actually lower than most industrial countries. And certainly it is in our system of government. It is like Hungary is higher.
Yeah, Hungary is. I mean, Hungary, which is the right wing ideal of a one party state that is a democracy on paper, but not anymore in any real sense. It is true that there's some idiosyncratic. The stories are a little bit different. Inflation in Europe is high, part because Vladimir Putin has cut off their natural gas supply,
sure,
and which is not an issue here. And inflation in the United States is high partly because we had a very full employment economy, which is not true of the Europeans. So that there's a little bit more domestic side to it here. But the things that people complain about are gas and food prices, which are...
And rent.
And rent. And none of those are the result of things that Washington does. It's not national policy. And the interesting news, particularly, if you're thinking about the midterm election, is that all of those things that are actually not under the control of policy happen to be breaking Biden's way at the moment. That may not be true 6 months from now, but it may very well be true 3 months from now.
Now, the Inflation Reduction Act, which basically is a clean energy act, it's most of that, the biggest part of that, right, is to address climate,
clean energy, and then a
Medicare,
healthcare,
not raising the premiums on the ACA. Yeah. And then help me understand this. So what I see is corporations have to pay at least 15% on their profits now, where they've been paying nothing. I don't understand that, because it feels to me like if you have profits, if your books say you have profits, you have to pay taxes on them. And if they somehow cook their books or use whatever they use to get the zero, then they're not profitable. So what is the distinction here? I don't understand how that works.
Basically, it's just one of those things where the law that defines, we have laws that define how corporations report their profits for accounting purposes. And those laws are there to protect investors. So the corporations are not supposed to just lie about how profitable they are.
Okay.
And then we also have laws that define profits for tax purposes, and those don't exactly match. It is quite possible for corporations to record. I mean, I'm pretty sure that if we use the sort of typical tax dodge where a corporation manages to do some clever cross subsidization with its overseas subsidiaries so that its profits pop up in Ireland, which has a low corporate tax rate, and not in the United States, that from the point of view of investors, Apple is honest and they say, we're making a ton of money. But from the point of view of the IRS, they say, oh, we're not making that money. Apple Ireland is making that money. And what this law does is it basically cracks down on that practice. It forces corporations that are reporting big profits to investors to also, in fact, pay taxes. And it's not entirely stupid that the law for what's taxable and the law for what's reportable are not quite the same, but this is a way of closing the really egregious abuse of the tax system.
So that sounds like something that the Finance Committee wrote that legislation to make that happen.
That's right. So they were looking for a way that was relatively simple, relatively enforceable to avoid the avoidance. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of tax avoidance out there, and this will cut into it. And there's so much tax avoidance that even making a modest dent in the problem is worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
So this scored as cutting the deficit, right?
Yeah.
Because of that. Is that right?
Yeah.
And less spending on Medicare pharmaceuticals.
That's right. Drug price negotiation is going to also, again, doing even fairly modest stuff can save you a lot of money.
But it's called the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, to me, it seemed like a climate change healthcare bill with some added, capturing these profits from corporations. It seemed to me like reducing inflation was not actually really going to do.
Like the Holy Roman Empire, which is neither holy nor Roman nor empire. You can do some intellectual contortions and say, well, maybe this slightly reduces inflation. But it's called that because Joe Manchin had been going on and on about inflation and was finally brought on board with this, but to be a sop to him to say, oh, we're addressing his concerns. They're calling it to this. It's a little bizarre.
Peter, Peter's my producer, and he edits this, and Manchin is a huge fan of the podcast. Peter, can you cut this out?
Yep. I will cut that out.
Oh.
No, I'm joking. That was a joke.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, it was harmless. Okay. I mean, to be honest, I found that this kind of misnaming here of it's less cheesy than the way a lot of bills are named. I mean, we have a semiconductor bill, which is a really good bill, by the way, to promote semiconductor production in the U.S., which is called the CHIPS bill. And that's for creating helpful incentives for production of semiconductors, which that strikes me as being seriously cheesy, but what the hell?
Well, wait a minute, but at least it says what it does.
No, again, what I really don't care what they call it. They could have called it the Puppies, Unicorns, and Rainbows Act. That would be fine with me.
Yeah, they go through the contortions to do an acronym. So good for them. I don't mind that, but and I don't if this calling it the Inflation Reduction Act got Manchin aboard and got it done. That's great, and it may have some small effect on inflation. And the student loan relief, the forgiveness. I asked you about this. This is not going to have an effect.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that some people who were burdened with student debt will not be, they'll be able to spend a bit more money, which means that there will be a bit more spending in the economy, other things equal, than there would have been. And that could be slightly inflationary. But if you actually do the math, it's just a tiny thing. It's not going to make any difference. In fact, we'll never know because there's enough noise in the data.
It's going to increase the deficit, and the size of the deficit affects inflation.
The fact of the matter is that realistically, deficit movements in the range of what we're talking about, even for the Inflation Reduction Act, those are not going to matter. The rate of inflation at this point is going to be determined by what Jerome Powell and the Fed do. If we had another $2 trillion in 1 year spending bill, that might make the Fed's job really harder. But we're talking now about sums of money that are really just a tiny, the U.S. has a $25 trillion economy. And it really is $100 billion here, $100 billion there. And eventually you're talking about real money. But the kinds of numbers we're talking about here are just not going to be enough to move the needle one way or the other.
I want to ask you about, talking about college debt, the economics of college. This is a big, big subject. But I'm wondering if you have thoughts on how we do college, who benefits from, not loan forgiveness, but how our higher education system works and what that's done in terms of class. And who's helped by it and who's hurt by it? Because there are people who get student loans and never get a degree. Do you have thoughts?
Yeah, we used to have a system which was pretty decent, which was that, all right, there were expensive private schools. And those are schools that people who weren't from wealthy backgrounds couldn't afford to go to unless the schools chose to give them big scholarships. But we also used to have a system of public schools, of public colleges and universities that were heavily subsidized and had really low tuition, where working class kids could go work their way through if necessary. But in any case, it just wasn't a huge financial burden. And a lot of the schools were really pretty good. And they provided an upward escalator for social mobility. Some of those things still exist. I teach at one of them. The City University of New York has quite low tuition. Most students get through without any debt. And it is, according to people who've studied this, it is in fact a big source of upward social mobility, much more so than the elite universities are. But for the most part, we kind of dismantled that. The public aid to public universities was scaled way back, and we shifted to this model where, college is great. You should get a degree. Why don't you go out there and borrow a lot of money to be able to attend college? Oh, and by the way, we're not going to do any vetting of the schools so that we can have completely scam programs and they still get federally backed loans. So we basically suckered a whole generation of young people into getting education that sometimes is valuable, sometimes isn't, but in any case comes along with this crippling burden of debt.
And what is that doing to this generation? I mean, there are people are getting, you know, can't buy houses. You know, they're stuck.
We screwed a lot of people, and there are some things on top of that, right? A lot of student debt was run up to get through college in the 2000s, and then students graduated into the post financial crisis world, where jobs were scarce and really right. hard to get up here and get on the first rung of the career ladder. And there we have some estimates of, you know, how long does it take to recover from the misfortune of graduating into a recession? And the answer is forever. If you kind of miss that first step because the economy is bad, then you are in trouble indefinitely. We created a trap for millions and millions of kids.
You know, Heather McGee told me a statistic, which is that Black households led by a college graduate have less wealth than a white household led by a high school dropout.
I haven't seen that number, but it's quite believable. Now, the enduring racial gaps are huge. So the idea that people are judged by the contents of their character, not the color of their skin, or even by their educational credentials, not the color of their skin, is just not true in America 2022.
And I also presume that a lot of that is wealth carried over from home ownership. You know, after World War II, the GI Bill, redlining made it very hard for Black soldiers, veterans to buy, and easy for white, and you accumulate that wealth. I mean,
Decisions that are made, things that were explicitly racist at one point and then implicitly racist later on and now are de facto still discriminate by race, those cast a very long shadow. Those can actually affect the way things are, not just years into the future, but even generations into the future.
Of course. And when we have this debate over whether there's systemic racism and has been in our society, it's unbelievable when people say no.
Yeah. Well, the idea that white males are the victims is an extraordinary thing, which you would find impossible to believe unless you knew anything at all about human nature.
Yeah, but there are white males in areas that were, you know, they grew up believing their kids would do better than them, right? And they aren't.
Oh yeah, no. If you are growing up in Eastern Kentucky, you know, a rural white growing up in Eastern Kentucky is facing a truly horrific environment. It's really hard to escape from that.
So I can kind of understand that and that resentment, and I think that's a big part of why Trump got elected in the first place, was that I think Americans started feeling, you know, basically after the Great Recession, oh boy, you know, my kids' life is not going to, they're not going to do better than I did. And that was sort of the guarantee here, I thought.
Yeah. And by the way, you see this, I mean, this is not a uniquely American thing. You can see that depressed areas in other Western countries also have turned to this kind of ugly, I hate the word populism because it's these movements don't actually seem to ever want to do anything for people, but still these kind of ugly right-wing movements. I mean, if you think about the former East Germany is a hotbed now of essentially neo-Nazi sentiment. And again, it's because it's a region that ended up being left behind with few opportunities.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Paul Krugman.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we have this war in Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
And we don't know how long that's going to go on. I do think we've been doing exactly the right thing. I think that Biden deserves a lot of kudos for putting this coalition together and keeping it together and is doing exactly the right thing, because if we don't, Russia will just, they won't stop, right?
Yeah.
That's what these people, that's what Putin is about. I don't know how long this is going to last. No one probably does. But at a certain point, let's say it ends, and let's say whatever the end is, there's going to have to be, and let's say Ukraine remains Ukraine. There's going to have to be rebuilding there, right? Yeah. And a kind of a Marshall Plan. What percentage of our GDP was the Marshall Plan? Do you know?
I think it was briefly about 2%. I'm pulling that out of thin air, I guess would be the polite way to say it. But right. it's in that it that was the peak for U.S. foreign aid. It's never actually been a big part of our economy. But yeah, I mean, Ukraine, assuming it survives, Ukraine's going to need a lot of aid. Now, a lot of that is going to come from the Europeans.
Yep.
As I understand it, Ukraine is basically it's going to be a while before they can actually join the European Union, but they can have a kind of candidate status, which already allows for substantial aid. And you look at other places that were very poor that the Europeans joined the EU, and they got substantial aid. And the big thing to say about Ukraine is it's a pretty poor place. The amount of money it would take to be transformative for, say, their infrastructure is pocket change for wealthy Western countries. So we can do with a lot. It's not going to break us at all.
Well, the best scenario, of course, is that Ukraine remains Ukraine, and yeah, that they can join the European Union and they can join NATO. In other words, we win.
Yeah. I mean, I'm feeling, I read the news. Yeah, I try to limit my reading of Ukraine war news to about 7 hours a day. But it's, they have been far more effective and brave than anyone imagined. So, and it turns out also that mythical, powerful Russian military isn't quite what they claimed it was. So,
well, you know, Ted Cruz said that what was great about them is they're very masculine.
Yeah. Oh, he showed this, shaven-headed, tattooed guy and saying that the advantage of not having a woke military. And it turns out that not being woke, it doesn't help if you're actually also kind of stupid.
Also, what he calls woke is like having women in the military, basically. Yeah. And if, first of all, there are women in the infantry, there, Tammy Duckworth flew a helicopter and was horribly wounded from that. But if you look at what our military is, think about how many people are in logistics. Think of how many people are in communications. Think about that. That's what a military runs on, as much as, the people, the fighting force, obviously. And that's been Russia's a big part of their downside, right?
Yeah, a lot of people I read who actually know this stuff say that people had forgotten about how important logistics is in war, because they had watched the U.S. in its various wars, and we don't seem to have problems with that. And they don't realize that's because the U.S. is superbly good at logistics, and nobody else can actually do that.
We do get into wars we shouldn't get into.
No, that's right. Look, something like I was very, very vocally opposed to the Iraq war, and we were lied into war and all of that. But in the waging of it, the one thing that you didn't have, American advances grinding to a halt because nobody had actually done routine repairs on our tanks. You know, it's the U.S. military is very good at what it does. Now, it's, sometimes it's told to do things that it shouldn't do. But the point was that Russia Russia is not America, and it doesn't matter how tough they may look or sound. They don't actually have the capabilities.
So you're seeing that in the next couple months, next few months, probably leading up to the election, that inflation will be coming down.
Yeah.
And that it really is that Biden doesn't really deserve any credit, but or much, and we'll get it.
Yeah. I mean, that there's a he got a lot of blame for stuff that wasn't his fault.
Yeah, right.
Now he's okay. Probably, well, you see it in the approval ratings, you know, it's probably a lot of it is just the price of gasoline. And at some level, there's a bit of cosmic justice here for him to be getting credit for stuff that wasn't his doing after having gotten blamed for stuff that wasn't his doing.
I'm going to make you president and Congress right now. So what would you do economically in this country if you had that power?
So let me just talk about first the stuff that is that I wish wasn't necessary, but probably is. We probably have to allow the unemployment rate to rise a bit.
It's amazingly low.
Yeah.
And in there was a story, I think, in the New York Times on Mankato, Minnesota. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Was in the, yeah. And yeah. They can't get workers. They just can't find people. And I knew this was happening before all this, but in southern Minnesota. This is, by the way, why we need immigrants.
Yes. Well, that's among my list would be to say, hey, let's immigrants would really help a lot. We could use a bigger labor force. And you say, well, how do we get people back into the workforce, get people to join the workforce? There's a bunch of things we can do, childcare and so on. But the easiest way to get more people in the workforce would be to let some more people in. And so that's, you know, again, if there were no political constraints, yeah, some more immigration would help. So we're going to have, but regardless, we're going to have to see some rise in unemployment, but maybe just a fraction of a percentage point, enough so that things aren't quite so tight and the inflationary pressures come down. And then you talk about what can we do for the future. The way I think about it is in those early days of the Biden administration, everybody was very hopeful. And there were really three things that we wanted to see done. One of them was repair infrastructure. We got that. Another was to do a serious stuff on climate. And we got that. But the third was to really invest in families and in children. Mm-hmm. And that's what we didn't get. The United States is actually, you know, we talk about the U.S. as having a weak social safety net, which we do. But the weakness, we actually spend a lot of money on people my age, right? We spend a lot of money on senior citizens. We have Medicare, we have Social Security, which should be more generous, but is still an important safety net. What we don't do compared with other countries is spend on younger people, and especially their aid to families with children.
The child tax credit.
Well, the child tax credit was the most immediate. Yes, for a little mm-hmm. while there, we briefly pretty much eliminated child poverty. We showed it could be done, but we couldn't get the legislation extended. And so if we come back, you know, give me an electoral miracle, Democratic control of that's stronger than we've had this past year and a half, then bring that back, and then probably a bunch of childcare as well.
You know, and of course, the childcare means that people can go to work.
It's even good that a real Inflation Reduction Act would probably include quite a lot of spending on childcare.
You know, I saw this in the New York Times, your paper. The average European country spends $7,000, subsidizes childcare per child to the tune of $7,000. In the United States, it's $500.
Okay, I haven't seen those numbers, but I always look at the support for non-elderly families. And most countries in the Western world spend something like 5% of GDP on that, and we spend under 2. We're just off the charts stingy on helping people who aren't senior citizens. And there happens to be a lot of evidence. This one of the odd things as you think, well, you know, infrastructure, that's steel and concrete. That's hard. That's solid. But the evidence that spending on infrastructure, it has to matter, but there's not a whole lot of solid evidence about what the payoff to it is. But we have, tremendous amount of evidence on the payoff to spending on children. We have evidence, you know, things like food stamps were rolled out across the country gradually. Not everybody, so we actually can compare the results from families that got access to food stamps earlier on. And children who have adequate financial support grow up to be healthier, more productive, more likely to be employed, higher earnings. The economic rate of return on spending on young people is enormous.
Well, universal pre-K was part of Build Back Better. That
universal
was a piece.
Pre-K, but also nutritional aid. I mean, healthcare.
Yes, all of that. But yeah. I'm a big advocate of early childhood education, and all the evidence points to that kids who have early childhood education are, one, less likely to be left back a grade. They're more likely to graduate high school. The girls are less likely to get pregnant in adolescence. They're more likely to go to college. They're more likely to get better. They're going to get better jobs, and they're much less likely to go to prison. And so it's stupid. The return on investment has been proven over and over again. And other countries, this is what they do. They have this. They have early childhood education.
Yeah. And what we saw is it's actually not hard. And it isn't even that much money. The thing is that, by and large, taking care of young people is cheap. You know, taking care of us doddering 65-plussers costs a lot of money because we end up needing things like dialysis and so on. But just making sure that kids have adequate health care and enough to eat and that their parents can work without having to have latchkey kids and all of that, it costs really a remarkably small amount of money for a really big payoff down the road.
Okay, so that stuff is stuff you would do if you're the president and control Congress.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it there was a way back in the day when Bernie Sanders said he wanted America to be like Denmark, and then was piling in on him. But yeah, I mean, Denmark ain't utopia, but it takes care of its kids. It has universal health care. And so these are not pie in the sky things.
Every other developed country has universal health care, every one of them. And some have single payer, but even single payer countries like Canada have private insurance.
I spent a lot of time over the years on healthcare. You know, there are different ways to do it. You can do it with a system where the government actually, where the doctors work for the government.
England has that. Have private insurance, even in Great Britain.
They have private insurance on top. Some people have extra. Nobody is dictatorially forcing you to use the system.
Well, Bernie, that was my objection to what Bernie. We would have lost big time in 20 with Bernie's plan, because it would have forced you to use the system. His plan eliminated all private insurance. Look, we picked up 41 seats in 2018 because Americans finally understood what they had. And they saw that because the Republican plan didn't guarantee in your state that you would be protected if you had pre-existing conditions, and it got rid of Medicaid expansion. So we picked up 41 seats.
by definition, those are purple seats. They turn red to blue. A lot of those districts are suburban. Those folks are happy with their private insurance. By and large, they get it through their employer who's paying, I don't know, 60 to 80% on average of their premiums. Why would they want to trade that for something that they just have no idea what it's going to look like? Single payer, they just don't know. And we just would have gotten clobbered in 2020 if we ran on single payer with no option to buy public insurance, which was Bernie's plan.
There's a tremendous bias that we all have, with which kind of makes sense towards, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
It is broke for a lot of people. There's no question about that.
But for the people who isn't broke, to say, okay, we're going to replace what you got with something completely different. Trust us, it'll be better. Even if it's true that it would be better, it's not going to fly politically. So incremental, I mean, the genius of the Affordable Care Act was that it left people who were, for the overwhelmingly, people who were satisfied with their healthcare arrangements were able to keep them. You know, Obama got in trouble for saying that if you like your health insurance, you can keep it. And there were a tiny number of people for whom that wasn't true. But by and large, you know, it was conservative in that, not in the normal political sense, but in the sense of leaving stuff that worked for people in place and then adding on to it.
And of course, we tried to get a public option. And that was Joe Lieberman killed that.
Yeah. So we can try, you know, that may come back. The most
makes perfect sense, of course.
And look, it is worth pointing out that at this point, with the extra subsidies for premiums and with an administration that's actually trying to make Obamacare work, we're now down to 8% uninsured, which would be a horrible number in any other advanced country, but for the United States is pretty damn good by historical standards.
And all the places where it's highest, of course, are the states that didn't accept Medicaid, right?
So a place like New York or California are pretty close, not all the way, but they're pretty close to universal health care. And it's, you take what you can, and that's a huge policy win. That's tens of millions of people.
And we were almost there in Minnesota, too. Medicaid expansion was covering more than 200,000 Minnesotans that hadn't been covered before. Now hospitals have to take folks into the emergency room, and if the patient isn't insured, the hospital has to eat the cost. So what happened in rural areas after we passed the Affordable Care Act, these people now had expanded Medicaid, and instead of the hospital eating the cost, Medicaid paid it. Medicaid expansion paid it. So suddenly there was a whole lot of less uncompensated care for these hospitals, and the rural hospitals had a lot more money. So they use that to expand their scope of care and pay for more nurses and doctors and technicians and more sophisticated technology. And suddenly people in these red communities were very happy with much, much more improved care that they were getting. And with these hospitals now flush with money, they often became the biggest employer in the county. And of course, Trump's campaign in 2016 was all about repealing and replacing Obamacare. So they win. And what do they come up with? Getting rid of Medicaid expansion. So after the Republicans' plan finally came out, people saw what it was. I'd go around to red counties and have these town hall meetings in these rural hospitals, and people were in these meetings. They were very afraid. For example, one piece of the increased scope of care at these in these rural areas was providing home care to older folks. I remember one couple at a rural hospital that was scared. They were crying because they both worked and they couldn't give their mom the care that she needed. And grandma would have had to go to a nursing home
which would have been terrible for her instead of being in her own home, and to boot, more expensive. And they were crying. I had people crying in these meetings. So the Republican plan went down, thank God. And what has happened, all these red states now that hadn't taken Medicaid expansion, suddenly they took it. And by public referendum, this is by public referendum, these are the most recent states to take Medicaid expansion. Idaho, Nebraska, Utah, Oklahoma, and Missouri. Red, red states.
One of the funny things is that even in red states, basic social insurance programs are extremely popular. For me, going way back, 2005, when, I don't know, do you remember when George W. Bush tried to privatize Social Security?
Oh, yes.
And which was memorable for me, from among other things, because it was the first time that my side of a policy debate actually won. But the reason that it ran aground was that everybody hated the idea. And in some ways, the red states hated it more than the blue states, because there are more people for whom Social Security is all they got.
Hey, can I run a policy idea by you that regarding the solvency of Social Security? It's called the Al Franken donut hole.
Okay,
here's what it is. I think most Americans think that you should pay FICA on all your income. There shouldn't be. What's the cap now? Where do you stop paying FICA?
It's 100 something.
It's like 120 well or something. Yeah. Okay. So here's my idea. It's the Al Franken donut hole. Okay. At 120, you don't pay any more FICA, but then it kicks in back in at 400 or 250 or 450. Somewhere. And then at that point, but when it kicks in, let's say it kicks in at 250, but then you don't pay the full FICA. You pay a little bit of it. And then at 400, you pay more of it. And at 500, you pay more. It's the Al Franken donut hole.
I mean, in reality, that's just saying that there's an income tax. We're raising taxes on high income people.
But it goes into Social Security and Medicare. That's the difference.
Yeah, though that's largely fictitious, right?
I mean, okay,
let me give you the reason that I probably wouldn't go that way, but I'll take it if we could get it. But but FICA is only levied on earned income, so it's not a tax on capital gains. It's not a tax on dividends and so on. So that's a way of raising taxes, but only on people who make a lot of money in the form of paychecks, and not others. My favorite line from the movie Wall Street. That would be a tax that would hit the 400,000 a year working Wall Street stiff, and not that guy's boss who's making billions. So, one way or another, the fact is that the future shortfall on Social Security is not that bad. Remember, we're thinking about, it's an aging population. The baby boomers have already mostly hit retirement age. Most of that demographic transition has already happened. So it's not like there's a huge bill waiting out there.
More immigrants.
More immigrants would solve the problem. Actually, more undocumented immigrants would really solve the problem,
because
they pay FICA and then don't never collect the benefits.
Yeah, let's do that.
But all of this stuff is really, given a modicum of political goodwill, all of these things are easy to solve. They're just not that much money relative to an economy as big as ours. Of course, my condition there, a modicum of political goodwill, that's what we're lacking. But that's the problem, not really, it's not the arithmetic.
It's not, the key words there aren't even goodwill, it's modicum.
Yes, well, yeah, I mean,
oh my God, is it bad? Well, that means we not only got to vote, but you got to get on the phones and you got to knock on doors, folks.
That's right. No, if we had if we had a more normal political balance, normal meaning looking like most other wealthy countries, then all of the problems we're talking about would be pretty easy to solve. Now, not want to say that America is uniquely bad. We may actually be about to have a neo-Mussolini party running Italy pretty soon. So we're all having these problems. But the U.S. does not have deep financial problems. It does not actually have deep economic problems. It has deep political problems.
Well, we'll solve that the next time, our next podcast together.
Okay.
Okay. And thank you for joining us and for your friendship and for your column. Folks, you got to read Paul Krugman's column and newsletters. To me, they're a must read, always a must read. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.